Hollow said carbon dioxide remains in the atmosphere for centuries and in the ocean for even longer. Last time the Earth experienced a comparable concentration of CO2 was 3 to 5 million years ago, when the temperature was 2 to 3 degrees Celsius warmer and sea level was 10 to 20 meters higher than now. The report also warned that land and oceans' ability to continue serving as carbon sinks, sucking up about half of CO2 emissions, could be negatively affected by climate crisis-related changes such as wildfires. Urging countries to turn commitment into action, Tala said, there is no time to lose. Dave Rhee, a professor at the University of Edinburgh and director of the Edinburgh Climate Change Institute, also tied the bulletin's findings to the upcoming UN Climate Summit. He said in the statement, "The true success or failure of COP26 will be written in our skies in the form of greenhouse gas concentrations." This is a new report from WMO, which provides a brutally frank assessment of what's been written there to date. He said, "So far, it's an epic fail. Will this 26th COP find success where the previous 25 have fallen short? Our atmosphere will bear witness."
Hunger strike is a protest method. Those who go on a hunger strike refuse food or drink. People use hunger strikes when they have no other way of protesting. Prisoners usually do this to protest their detention conditions, call for a change in a policy, or bring attention to a specific matter. By drawing international attention to the plight of prisoners, they aim to put pressure on their jailers and spur a change in policy. That's what Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have been doing. For decades, thousands of Palestinian inmates have gone under hunger strikes to protest their situation, the administrative detention, and the fact that the Israeli regime has no right to hold them without any specific reason.
As for Hiba, she was arrested on August 15th at the Kerama border crossing where she was on her way from Jordan to the West Bank. She was held and interrogated at an intelligence center, being denied any liars. The commission's liar visited her 2 days ago, and in her report, she said Hiba's lost around 10 kilograms. She's been isolated, abused, assaulted, and held in brutal conditions. She informed the liar she won't end the hunger strike as long as she's held under administrative detention.
Israeli occupation is primarily responsible for the life of Maher al-Akhras because after more than 70 days of a hunger strike, he suffered serious weight loss and he repeatedly loses consciousness. His heart could suddenly stop. Today he's in a serious health condition. This requires immediate intervention from all sides to reach a solution to save his life.
Under international law, Israel is responsible for the well-being of all persons in its custody. So hunger strikes can be used to pressure the occupying regime. Earlier this month, a mass hunger strike was staged across Israeli jails. Up to 400 Palestinian inmates went on a hunger strike. Just in September, another 1,400 Palestinian prisoners launched a hunger strike. Both hunger strikes were in reaction to the punitive measures imposed on Palestinian inmates following the escape of six Palestinians from Gilbo prison last month. It all started on September 6th when Israeli jail authorities realized that six inmates had escaped the maximum security jail through a tunnel. The jailbreak made a mockery of Israeli authorities. Although all six escapees were captured, the fact that they carried out such an operation right under the nose of prison guards made it quite embarrassing. So in response, the Israeli prison service cracked down particularly hard on prisoners belonging to the Islamic Jihad, to which five of the escapees belong. The Israelis transferred several prisoners belonging to the Islamic Jihad to solitary confinement, and leaders of the movement were transferred to interrogation cells. The conditions the prisoners were living under were so harsh, they decided to stage a hunger strike. In a statement, the prisoners said the strike is a rebellion and rejection of prison administration laws. Since 1968, Palestinians have been launching mass and individual hunger strikes after Israel occupied the remaining Palestinian territories of the West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. The first strike was on February 18, 1969, in Ramleh prison. The prisoners protested meager portions and poor quality food, as well as the policy of banning writing stationery and being forced to address their jailers as sir. The strike ended when prison authorities put the prisoners in solitary confinement. In July 1970, Abdul Ghader Abu Al-Fahm became the first Palestinian prisoner to die during a hunger strike. Al-Fahm died because of force feeding by Israeli prison authorities, who inserted a nasal feeding tube into his lungs instead of his stomach. Israel constantly uses this method of force feeding prisoners on hunger strike. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has called on Israel to ensure that prisoners on hunger strike are not subjected to force feeding or other medical treatment against their will, as it could amount to torture. The world body also said the practice under no circumstances will comply with human rights standards. A hunger strike in September 1984 is considered a turning point in the history of hunger strikes. 800 prisoners reportedly joined the strike for better conditions in the Nablus prison. Prisoners were crammed into overcrowded cells, suffering from a lack of ventilation and no reading material. The strike brought about many changes, such as bringing in a radio, TV, clothes, and better quality food. In 1992, one of the most successful hunger strikes across Israeli jails occurred. 7,000 prisoners joined the movement. The strike resulted in major achievements, such as shutting down the prison's isolation section, stopping strip searches, increasing family visitation time, and allowing cooking slates in the cells. Miqdad Qawasmi is the latest individual who has staged a hunger strike against his administrative detention. The last time the 24-year-old was on the news, he was in an intensive care unit after 91 days of strikes. It's often said that hunger strikes are a non-violent form of protest, but by refusing food and drink, protesters put their lives in danger. They risk permanent damage to their health and eventually death. Even after a protester decided to end a hunger strike, there is the potential risk of refeeding syndrome. This syndrome occurs because of the shifts in fluids and electrolytes, meaning that giving too much food or fluids too quickly may be dangerous and potentially fatal. It may include liver dysfunction, heart arrhythmia, and pulmonary, neurological, or other symptoms. There are cases in which hunger strikes can amount to torture as well. There are currently 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, including 35 women and 200 children. All these hunger strikes are just last desperate calls for help from Palestinian prisoners. Will the international community finally do something serious for them?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S.-led coalition, despite the staggering $2 trillion investment and the most advanced weaponry and intelligence, failed to eliminate terrorist groups like Daesh in Afghanistan, which lends credence to the theory that the group essentially serves America's objectives in the volatile region. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor, and blogger with over 10 years of experience, who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran for leading publications. The piece is titled, U.S. Has a New Proxy in Afghanistan, Daesh. The last U.S. occupation forces beating a hasty and humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, the war has entered a new phase where Americans and Daesh terrorists find themselves on the same side. The resurgence of Daesh terrorist group on the back of the U.S. exit has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban-ruled country in a way that works perfectly to the advantage of the Americans. The country, lying at the crossroads of South and Central Asia, has been rocked by a series of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, from Nangarhar in the east to Kunduz in the north, Kandahar in the south, and the capital Kabul. The ghastly bombings were claimed by Daesh terrorists in its new, more dangerous incarnation. It can be argued the aim is to undermine the newly established rule of its arch-enemy, Taliban, and to stir sectarian tensions and civil war in a country with deep ethnic and religious fault lines. That's precisely what the Western powers, who spent years in the futile military adventure in Afghanistan, have been looking for. The move to freeze $10 billion of Afghan assets has to be seen in the same context, which is primarily designed to bring poor and war-weary Afghans to their knees. The disastrous end of the U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan 2 months ago also saw the resurgence of a terrorist group that has long shared love-hate relationship with the West. Amid the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces, Daesh terrorists and Daesh suicide bombers detonated their explosives outside Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport on 26th of August, killing over 170 Afghans, many of them making a desperate attempt to flee the country. 13 American troops were killed as well in the attack, which prompted the U.S. to launch a drone strike on 29th of August. That drone strike, ostensibly aimed at a Daesh hideout, mowed down 10 more poor Afghan civilians. It was America's parting gift to the people of Afghanistan, a people they held hostage for 20 years. In the weeks after the final withdrawal, Daesh terrorists carried out several low-intensity attacks in their stronghold of Nangarhar in eastern Afghanistan, mainly targeting overground Taliban fighters. It was a continuation of a long-running turf war between the two groups with competing interests. In early October, the group went back to its favorite mode of urban warfare, suicide bombings. The sprawling Eidgah Mosque in Kabul was targeted on 3rd of October, killing 7 civilians. The attack took place during the funeral ceremony of Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid's mother. The worst was yet to come. While targeting Taliban convoys and funerals serves the purpose of undermining the newly established interim government, the other and more important purpose is served by attacks on minority groups. In both cases, Daesh terrorists has made common cause with Americans. On 8th of October, a deadly bombing ripped through a mosque in northern Kunduz province during Friday prayers, leaving over 150 people martyred, all members of the ethnic Hazara Shia community. A week later, another mosque was bombed in southern Kandahar province, which claimed over 60 lives. Both attacks, with the same set of victims and perpetrators, bore striking resemblance to each other. The modus operandi was the same, and the objective was the same. Victims in both incidents were buried in mass graves and, like always, reduced to cold statistics in the Western media. Daesh, which first made inroads into the Hindu Kush country in late 2014, has fought pitched battles with the Taliban in eastern Afghanistan all these years. At the same time, it has played the sectarian card by targeting the Hazara Shia community, as was clearly evident in recent weeks. Ironically, what Daesh terrorists are doing is no different from what the successive US-backed regimes in Kabul have done for a long time, except that the latter didn't claim responsibility for any act of terror. They paved the way for it and refused to take any measures to put a stop to it. I suppose that is more reprehensible. The narrative that the US military-industrial complex has contributed to the growth of terrorism perpetrated by Daesh in Afghanistan has been gaining ground for quite some time now. The US-led coalition, despite the staggering $2 trillion investment and the most advanced weaponry and intelligence, failed to eliminate terrorist groups like Daesh in Afghanistan, which lends credence to the theory that the terrorist group essentially serves the objectives of the United States of America in the volatile region. Taliban officials have unequivocally blamed the United States for Daesh terrorist group's resurgence in Afghanistan. Ahmad Yasser, an official at Taliban's political bureau in Doha, Qatar, was recently quoted as saying that there is evidence to suggest that recent attacks on Shia mosques in Afghanistan had malicious foreign hand behind them. Qari Sayyid Khosti, who handles social media for Taliban, also held Americans responsible for the recent Daesh bombings. He refused groups' cooperation with the United States in fighting Daesh, saying the Takfiri terrorist group had made comeback with the help of the Americans and its Western allies. The leader of the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, in a speech recently, also stressed that the United States must take responsibility for Daesh presence in Afghanistan, accusing Americans of shipping Daesh terrorists from Syria into Iraq and Afghanistan. This claim, dismissed as a conspiracy theory by Western pundits, has been often repeated by credible military sources. There are also reports that the Taliban's interim government has been unable to locate the previous government's security files, which include critical information on Daesh terrorists. The files were discarded by the US occupying forces before they fled the country. According to a United Nations report released in June, interestingly, in the months before the US-led coalition forces left the country, some 8,000 to 10,000 terrorists made their way to Afghanistan from Central Asia, from North Caucasus, Pakistan and Syria. Most of them were recruited by Daesh terrorists, which was evident from the Kunduz mosque bombing that was carried out by a Takfiri terrorist group. What is most remarkable is that these foreign terrorists slipped into Afghanistan under the very nose of US and NATO forces. Americans had the intelligence, but the political will was missing. Top US military commander Mark Milley went on record recently as saying that there is possibility of a broader civil war, reconstitution of Al-Qaeda, and the growth of Daesh terrorists. But no action has been taken because Americans now see Daesh as a potential proxy to continue their botched mission in the war-ravaged country.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The International Islamic Unity Conference is held annually in Tehran. The conference brings together Shia and Sunni scholars and intellectuals from around the world. On Sunday, Iran's Islamic Revolution leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed Iranian officials and foreign participants at the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized the importance of unity. He stated that the reason for his repeated emphasis on this issue is the large divide that exists across faiths, with enemies attempting to increase it. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. tries to sow discord among Muslims by raising the issue of Sunni and Shia. Both Shia and Sunnis agree on most of the fundamental beliefs and practices of Islam. Their bitter divide goes back some 14 centuries. It began with disagreement about who should succeed the Prophet Muhammad as the leader of Islamic faith, but the two have coexisted despite the differences. Ayatollah Khamenei further said, "Unity among Muslims is a principal command by the Holy Quran and not a tactic dictated by circumstances." He added that a novel Islamic civilization can only be established when Shia and Sunni Muslims converge in a united front. In his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei also said that Palestine serves as the top criteria for unity in the Muslim world. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized certain regional states for normalizing relations with Israel, calling the approach sinful and wrong. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates signed the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords at the White House in 2020 to normalize ties with the occupying Israeli regime. Morocco and Sudan later signed normalization agreements with Israel as well. Daesh has maintained a foothold in eastern and northeastern Afghanistan following the United States' hasty withdrawal from the country, which led to the collapse of the Afghan government and the Taliban takeover in mid-August. Daesh has claimed responsibility for several attacks against the Taliban recently. It has also targeted Shias in Syria and Iraq in the past. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, touched on the U.S. attempt to incite unrest among Islamic countries through its proxies. Ayatollah Khamenei blamed the U.S. for a recent wave of terrorist attacks by Daesh targeting Shia Muslim mosques in Afghanistan that killed scores of people. Ayatollah Khamenei said one method to prevent such incidents is for present Afghan leaders to visit Shia centers and mosques and urge Sunni Muslims to join interreligious congregations.
Yes. I mean, it's very clear that the U.S. has always been backing these mercenary terrorist networks such as Daesh, and it serves their cause as long as the Muslim Ummah has disunity and there's this sedition and this hatred that is being bred inside the Islamic world, then they can easily control the region, take over the resources, build their bases, and secure their puppets that they have installed in place.
Ayatollah Khamenei urged Islamic countries to set aside their differences and stressed that unity among Muslims will create synergy and strengthen them in interacting with non-Islamic countries.
Israel seized large parts of Syria's Golan Heights during the Six-Day War of 1967. Most of the Syrian inhabitants had to flee the area. Syria tried to retake the occupied territory in 1973 in a surprise operation, but despite inflicting heavy losses on Israeli forces in that conflict, it failed to liberate Golan. The two sides signed an armistice the following year, and ever since, a United Nations observer force has been deployed on the ceasefire line. International law says Israel must withdraw its forces from the occupied Syrian territory and hand it over to Syria. But just like other parts of Israeli-occupied territories, such as the West Bank, Israel has been defying international law and has been building there. The Israeli regime unilaterally annexed Syria's Golan Heights in 1981, but the international community never recognized the move. In 2019, former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a proclamation officially recognizing the annexation, drawing condemnation from Syria and most of the world. Despite continued worldwide support for the liberation of the Heights, Israel seems to be planning to stay and expand its settlements there. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said recently that Israel will keep the territory. He also pledged to double the size of the Israeli settlers on the Golan, which is at around 20,000 in 30 settlements. The regime has now decided to push ahead with a plan to build thousands of new settler units. Since taking office in June, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has sped up expansion of settlements, and the new Golan project seems to be in line with his policy. Syria is infuriated by the regime's intensified violations in the occupied territory. Syria called on the United Nations Security Council this week to assume its responsibility and pile pressure on Israel to halt its illegal practices in the Golan Heights. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sabah, said Golan will return to the homeland sooner or later, and all the measures taken by the regime are null and void and have no legal effect. What can Syria and the international community do to push Israel to stop building on lands that international law says must be given back?
The only thing that can be done here is a policy of maximum pressure, either through armed resistance when you are in the region itself, like has been shown by the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, and various other groups surrounding the Zionist entity itself, or if you are a nation that is further away, through continued political pressure, through support to the Palestinian cause, and through economical sanctions.
Israel has been taking advantage of American support and the decision by some Arab states to normalize ties with Tel Aviv to advance its expansionist agenda. So it will not be easy to pile political pressure on Israel at the UN or in other international bodies. But grassroots campaigns like the increasingly popular boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel have managed to hurt Israel and raise awareness about its unending violations. The movement has targeted companies that are involved in Israeli settlement construction on occupied lands. The movement also encourages international boycott of products made or partly produced in Israeli settlements.
Right. The boycott, divest, and sanction movement is has shown to be a quite effective and efficient method, be it, of course, one of limited means in which we specifically only talk about boycotting Israeli products. But this has already yielded some fruit. We know this because the Zionist entity has been rapidly trying to ban and illegalize the BDS movement wherever it exists.
Any new settlement in the Golan Heights could be the next target of the BDS movement.
Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probe into Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shataya called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Azam Qasem said the move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence. Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Jabarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clearer position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now, but it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any persecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes. That has given Israel the audacity to time and again attempt to defame and sabotage the work of Palestinian human rights groups to end its impunity. The regime's latest move to blacklist six Palestinian human rights groups is yet another example of Israel's systematic and relentless campaign against Palestinian civil society organizations and leading human rights defenders. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has described Tel Aviv's declaration as characteristic of totalitarian regimes with the clear purpose of shutting down these organizations. In fact, this move threatens to shut down civil society groups that document human rights violations by Israel. They report human rights abuses against Palestinian children, advocate rights of the thousands of Palestinians held as political prisoners by Israel, and so forth.
Well, I think the Israeli government has long attempted to crush any information about their violations, about, you know, for instance, to the international courts, about all sorts of violations of international law, and that this is a continuation of their policy of suppressing criticism of the occupation and the siege of Gaza.
Human rights defenders are not terrorists and should never be accused like this. Clearly, Israel intends to silence the violations that it is committing in the occupied territories by attacking the civil society organizations. Therefore, if not responded to swiftly and properly, this could give the green light to Tel Aviv that it can shamelessly continue its crimes against Palestinians.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. He was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could, or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September the 2nd, 2021. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praises due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with God on earth. You are very welcome, dear brothers. I congratulate all of you for the blessing to be present in the main centers of serving the people. God the Exalted has bestowed on you the blessing to be present in the main centers of serving the country, the nation, and the Islamic Republic. You should appreciate the value of this blessing. I also wish to thank the Islamic Consultative Majlis for having carried out its duties on time. I hope that this will be a good and auspicious beginning for you and the country. Government Week is ornamented with the names of Shahid Rajai and Shahid Bahonar. In other words, it is ornamented with the name and remembrance of martyrdom. God's mercy be upon those two great, outstanding and active men who were blessed with martyrdom. They truly intended to serve.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Although their term of service was short, they showed that they had entered the arena with purity and with the intention of rendering services. They had an Islamic, popular and jihadi mentality. This is a lesson for all existing officials. You, dear brothers, have accepted your responsibility in a difficult time. I hope that God will help you. I too pray, and I hope that you succeed. These are difficult circumstances considering the high rate of inflation, the people's livelihood problems, the issue of coronavirus, and the various other problems that exist. If on the one hand you work in a diligent, untiring, and round-the-clock way, and if you rely on God the Exalted as a reserve and as an investment, you will definitely win and succeed, and you will overcome problems. You should make your intentions divine. And divine intention in this position of yours means having the intention to serve the people. If you enter the field with the genuine intention of serving the people, this is a divine and pure intention, one that will become blessed by God.
You've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iran is a land of ethnic diversity, and that is reflected in different languages, cultures, and of course, music. After over a one-year hiatus due to the coronavirus, the Iranian Folk Music Festival has once again hosted musicians from across Iran, each playing their local tunes using their indigenous instruments.
I come from the northern Khorasan province. I am so happy to be part of this music festival, to share my city's music with my fellow Iranians from other cities. I've brought our local instruments, such as sorna, which is an ancient Iranian woodwind instrument, and dhol, which is a local type of drum.
We in Sistan and Baluchistan province play sitar, which we also call tambure. We also play qaychak, which is a type of a bowed lute, similar to kamanche. We usually play in celebrations.
Every night during the three-day festival, different local ensembles took to the stage to perform, so the audience could listen to Kurdish, Baluchi, Azeri, and Arabic tunes in a matter of a few hours. And this is my favorite part. On the sidelines of the festival, bands from different ethnicities get together and improvise. This is where music transcends languages and interconnects various cultures.
Music is a language that needs no translation. We may not understand each other's languages, but as you could see, different people are interacting peacefully through music.
It's so interesting to see artists from different parts of a country perform together. This is the true meaning of national unity that binds us despite our cultural differences.
Organizers say that's the main purpose of holding such an event, to unite different ethnicities through the language of music.
Music is an integral part of society's identity and history, and Iran is no exception. So the festival tries to both introduce the local music of different ethnic groups in Iran while establishing peace and friendship among them.
Organizers also hope that the festival would help revive Iran's folk music, which has long been overshadowed by some of the heavily invested genres, like pop.
Through music, it's easier to grasp the ethnic diversity in Iran, because music itself is a language, a universal language that speaks the beauty of differences and peaceful coexistence of different cultures as one nation. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kerman.
The sanctions by the United Nations Security Council against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs have been in place for more than a decade. The UN now acknowledges that the U.S.-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
DPR Korea has never been more isolated from the international community than at this point in time. This is having a dramatic impact on the human rights of the people inside of the country and dampens hopes of achieving sustainable peace and security on the Korean Peninsula.
The special rapporteur was echoing and backed the call by some member states for sanctions relief for North Korea.
There must be a move back towards the spirit of multilateral cooperation that enabled the foundation of the United Nations in the first place.
This weekend, the South Korean and U.S. envoys on North Korea met in Seoul, with South Korea calling for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, and the U.S. agreeing to discuss the proposal later. The U.S. has often repeated that it's willing to meet with North Korea anywhere, anytime, without preconditions.
U.S. officials have now added that the country holds no hostile intent toward North Korea, while at the same time pressing for stronger implementation of the controversial United Nations Security Council sanctions.
South Koreans expressed their hope the international community could at least provide humanitarian aid.
The United Nations need to support North Koreans so that they don't continue to suffer from starvation.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has sought to build peace with North Korea, arranging summits and proposing other avenues of engagement, while the U.S. maintained a hard line. President Moon will leave office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Yemeni human rights group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a report on casualties caused by 6 years of Saudi-led war on Yemen. The report says more than 44,000 civilians have been killed or injured since 2015 when Riyadh launched an aggression against Sana'a. Thousands of women and children are among the victims, according to the report.
We released a report on the casualties of the Yemen war during the past 2,400 days of the conflict. 44,221 civilians were killed or injured, targeted by airstrikes and cluster bombs. More than 4,000 children and 2,800 women are among the victims who lost their lives.
Also, hundreds have been left with permanent disabilities. The report says thousands of civilian facilities were also targeted by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes. Hospitals, schools, and power stations were bombed across Yemen, affecting lives of millions of Yemenis in a country already hit hard by poverty.
The Saudi-led coalition has deliberately targeted civilian facilities to kill civilians. It did not differentiate between civilian and military targets. The coalition has violated international laws that ban military attacks on civilian facilities.
However, infrastructure are not the only civilian targets hit by Saudi and coalition warplanes. According to the report, more than 500,000 homes have been destroyed during the war. As a result, millions of Yemenis have been displaced across the country.
The ongoing Saudi war and the blockade imposed on Yemen is killing more Yemenis as it has deprived millions of civilians, including children, of their basic needs such as food and medicine. However, the international community remains silent regardless of the situation in Yemen, which the United Nations describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Human rights organizations warn that the long-term Israeli blockade has led to deterioration of water crisis in Gaza, making the enclave's water undrinkable. The organizations also said the crisis has led to poisoning of the residents of the besieged enclave. The situation was exacerbated by an acute electricity crisis that hampered the operation of water wells and sewage treatment plants, leading about 80% of Gaza's untreated sewage to be discharged into the sea, while 20% seeps into underground water.
We suffer from shortage of water. Sometimes we are without water for weeks. Meanwhile, the available water is very salty, polluted, and unfit for daily uses, especially in the refugee camps. Palestinians here are forced to buy mineral water for drinking, but only a few of them can afford having it.
Israel's attacks on Gaza last May have doubled the crisis, as the attacks pounded the enclave's already crumbling infrastructure. This presents a serious threat to the Gaza population's health, where recent data indicates that about a quarter of the diseases spreading in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and a great number of deaths of young children and infants are linked to intestinal diseases related to polluted water.
Many children and elderly people are suffering from serious diseases due to the polluted water. Most of the families here go to hospitals on a weekly basis as they have kidney problems. We call on the International Human Rights Organization to support us.
The human rights groups also warned that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Recent developments in Afghanistan have marginalized attention to coronavirus crisis in the country. In the meantime, officials and doctors at Kabul's Afghan Japan COVID-19 hospital say no money has been paid to the hospital, pushing it further towards a closure.
We have many problems as the cold season is approaching. We expect another wave of the virus in coming weeks. We ask our ex-donors to pay the salaries of the employees. We can't run the hospitals on our own. If their assistance is not resumed, the only COVID-19 hospital of Afghanistan will close.
Patients getting treatment in the hospital complain about insufficient medical supplies and care, urging the international bodies to save the hospital from closing and so the lives of Afghans.
My father has contracted the coronavirus. We are here for weeks. Everything seemed okay, but today we see that the hospital suffers from lack of oxygen and medicines. Meanwhile, the doctors have not been paid for months.
This comes as the U.S. insists on freezing nearly $9.5 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank and stopped shipment of cash to the nation. The U.S. says the assets will not be available to the Taliban, which remains on the Treasury Department's sanctions designation list. In addition to many humanitarian crises, the halt in global aid and the freezing of Afghanistan's assets have led to closure of most COVID-19 hospitals in the country. This comes amid warnings that Afghanistan could face COVID-19 outbreaks in the coming year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protecting press freedom. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marching all the way to the British Royal Courts of Justice today ahead of an upcoming extradition hearing. The starting point, the BBC headquarters.
One of the main issues that we have with Assange is that his extradition, the case which is being heard next week, the whole basis of the case, the facts about the case, most of this never gets anywhere near the British media.
The U.S. government is attempting to extradite Assange under an old treaty with the U.K. for publishing damning documents of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and human rights violations elsewhere. His supporters say the charges are politically motivated.
It means basically that every journalist anywhere in the world has to be afraid of a possible extradition. Especially if he is reporting on national security issues, not just by the United States or other Western countries, but by any country.
Just last month, it was revealed that in 2017, as Assange began his fifth year holdup in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the U.S. government plotted to kidnap or assassinate him on British soil. Still, the U.K. is